Okay, not easy, but good.
Okay, let's do our readings. Let's get those done.
Hang in there. Okay, Lisa. Flip chapter 8.
Okay, you want to flip chapter 8 on the verbal data. I suppose my goal here is to summarize the argument of chapter a little bit. And I, as I was reading, I tried to identify the types, type 1, type 2, type 3, that I thought were associated with each disability. Maybe you can help me along, whether I've understood or misunderstood or that sort of thing. So type 1, the description, type 2, understanding perspective, and type 3, functions.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to look at the different types of interviews as I was through the lens of those types mainly. So as you all know, they talked about, or Flip talks about, four different types of semi-structured interviews. And he started off talking about the focused interview. And the reason he included that kind of confused me up until the very end of the article, and he sort of made it clear to me that the focused interview was the driving force behind the semi-structured interview, and therefore that's why he included the description of it. But it sort of didn't seem to fit with the rest of them as I was reading it. So there are four elements of the semi-structured interview. He talked about the non-direction of the semi-structured interview. Let's say that you're going to watch a film, or you had your participants watch a film, and then you would ask a question like, what impressed you most in the film? So non-direction, kind of like I guess vague would be a way of saying that. And then I thought that was sort of strange, because the next element was specificity. You wanted to bring up the specifics in the interviewee. So I thought that the non-direction and the specifics kind of contradicted one another. I thought that was kind of curious. You also want to attempt to get a range of information. So you want the interviewee to cover all relevant topics to your research question. So you'd use things like reversal transitions and things like that. The last element of that type of interview was you wanted to try to achieve some sort of depth and get the person to reveal some personal context. And another thing that I thought was sort of interesting was that your goal would be to have your interviewee go beyond the comfortable. And that sort of brought up questions of ethics for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like trying to push people that way just didn't seem right. But so I thought that this sort of felt into type 2 analysis. Like you're focusing on perspective. You're not really focusing on things. You're not really focusing on functions, but it could be type 3, I suppose, depending on how you chose to analyze the data.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does anybody have anything to say about that? Or do you agree with me or follow me? Or no? Now I'm looking at Fiona directly.
I know, I'm like looking around going, you're staring at me.
You've got a very perplexed look on your face, yeah.
No, I was just wondering, going back about the non-direction versus specificity, because
mm-hmm.
I see the non-direction is not leading a person. You're not planting something into
okay.
their head,
mm-hmm.
but specificity, you want them to be very specific rather than just saying,
mm-hmm.
well, I kind of liked this part of it,
yeah.
and you want to know why.
That's right.
Okay.
And I think that what I was going to add to that is that the idea of shifting depth is more about what
yes.
meaning that the specificity is still not telling them what, leading
yes.
them what to say. But trying to get them to say what they are saying at deeper level. Okay.
Okay.
And I thought those were kind of interesting strategies and worth perhaps at another point for you maybe to think about examples, coming up with examples of how you might shift the depth, and maybe in your own interviews when you're conducting them this week you might consider that, because
mm-hmm.
that is something that happens quite frequently. You know, just trying to get people to move into saying more about that instead of saying it at very superficial level.
One other thing I noticed that just with all the interview types, there seems to be a real tension between trying to stick to your interview guide and trying to get and allowing the person to talk about
mm-hmm.
talk freely about, and to relate their perspective. I thought that was interesting. So the epistemological, help me out here, epistemological. Thank you. There you go. That kind of goal behind the semi-structured interview was to generate hypotheses, mm-hmm. and groups were defined in advance, and the focus was on the impact of concrete events. Problems and limitations associated with this type of interview would be the situational competence of the interviewer. And they said, and I thought it was funny, this can be overcome by rehearsal and through the development of expertise and interview training. And I really wonder, can you learn that kind of, to me that would be hard to learn. I guess you could develop expertise. I think I would find an interview like that. Well, I'll talk about that later when I talk about the group. I think the focus groups later that I'll talk about would be more comfortable than this would be. Mm-hmm. It would be more comfortable if you've got an interview guide in front of you. Mm-hmm. But I think it would take a certain amount of talent to be able to dig these things out of people.
Yeah. It's still a play between there are skills mm-hmm. and then there is experience. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the more you practice, the more you do it. And then there are the more difficult to imagine training things like Bebe was talking about with Jackson and her ability to give the look, you know, and the, you know, those are more difficult things, but not impossible things mm-hmm. to train, just things that you often just have to bring to people's awareness mm-hmm. and that these exist and that there is a way of being. And also it's about developing a self-monitoring process mm-hmm. during the interview, so you're not so caught up with the story and what the person's saying and with what questions you want to ask that you're not able to monitor those other things, like, you know, is something going on here? Is this, you know, should I abandon it at this point? You know, should I not ask those questions or should I just forget my schedule because this is such great stuff and it's so useful mm-hmm. at that level? Mm-hmm. I think that's all it's alluding to.
Back to a little bit of summary here, the goals of the semi-standardized interview. From my interpretation, I thought that the aim of this type of interview would be to reconstruct the subjective view for the interview, so type two. Yep.
We're semi-structured or we're still at the focus?
Semi. No, I didn't even talk about the focus. I didn't see it as relevant other than that it would get
provided
a framework. So just to the reconstruction of the subjective theories of the interviewee, and I believe I took the word reconstruction out of the chapter, mm-hmm. and the word construct made me think of postmodernism, which made me think of type 3. Mm-hmm. So trying to identify.
I think you can get at type 3 areas easier with confrontational techniques.
Yeah, with that.
It's one that Edwards uses and Parker uses in their research. They even talk about them. Or anyone doing sort of rhetorical analyses is interested in that.
Or getting at their implicit assumptions, right? Trying to get at the underlying reasons for doing things, I suppose. The types of tools associated with the semi-standardized interview. Using questions, theory-driven questions, hypothesis-directed questions, and the structure-laying technique. Now, if I understood this, I don't know what everybody else understood. You would interview somebody and then think of all the concepts that came up during the interview and then write them on little cards. And then you have the person you're interviewing read what structural laying technique is about, and then you'd show them an example of somebody having done it, and then you would ask them to do it. Is that how that went?
I think, no, isn't it more you're taking it back to them and then asking them to comment further?
I misunderstood them. I thought that you were supposed to write things on cards and have.
Well, that's one way to do it.
Okay.
Aren't you just verifying to see it's correctly represented? That what they think?
Yeah, and possibly getting them a chance to elaborate, mm-hmm. you know, or even contradict what your concepts are, what you've come up with.
The way I read the chapter, I found the way you described it really cumbersome and kind of, and they also said that people don't actually do it in its purest form, and it sounded very complicated to me. I don't know mm-hmm. if it is. Do people do it that way, or
some people would feel much more comfortable if they put it all on cards and lay it all out. Other people have done it with diagrams, like Smith. Mm-hmm. Remember, he had the repertory grid diagrams mm-hmm. that he took. When I took my material back to my participant, I had text her exact words.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just said, you said, and then I showed her the transcript and said, I was thinking that that might mean. So I did it in a very more informal way, but I actually had her words in front. You know, because her reading her own words is what enabled her to then say. Because I think if you move to the cards with the concept,
mm-hmm.
you've already removed the what the person actually said,
mm-hmm.
you know, away from them. And I think it's just my personal thing. It's much more useful for them to see what they said, and then how you've interpreted it, and then let them respond.
Mm-hmm.
Well, depending on the nature, the type of subject and context. One example that I was told to do was after I finish my paper report, take it back to the interviewee, have them read it and see if they agree. Or if not agree, see if they find other interpretations for what they said and then go back and rewrite. Because incorporating, this is what I said, but this was my intent. You found something that I agree with, or well, maybe it was there, and then is that the type of triangulation?
Mm-hmm.
And so is that the same, along the same lines?
You could do it that way. You're assuming a certain level of understanding on the part of your participants, though, aren't you? I mean, if you're writing an academic report that's full of jargon, and I'm not sure that it would be the useful thing to do in that situation. But if you're interviewing people who are at the same level of comprehension that you're at, you know, with what you're doing, then they would be much more like a co-researcher, and you would be looking at co-authoring the report. Co-authoring is a different issue. It's not triangulation, and it's not what we're talking about here, but it's another idea to think about, co-authorship. If you are working with someone who is an expert in their field and at a comparable level of understanding, or even different level above understanding, co-authorship can be a very interesting, unique way of doing this kind of work. Good.
Another kind of interview that talked about was the problem-centered interview. Using the interview guide to collect biographical data and to keep the conversation centered around the problem of interest, the problem that the interviewer is trying to data.
This one probably felt the most usual, in an educational context,
mm-hmm.
in particular.
Yeah, so your problem is identified beforehand, you're interested in the subjective viewpoints of your interviewee, and your aim is to develop theory. The tools associated with this type of interview would be conversational entry, ad hoc prompts, and how the interview guide. Problem associated with this is it's over pragmatic, not distinguishable from other types of interviews. I sort of felt that. It sort of sounded very similar to the other one. And the prompts are not adequate enough to prevent the interviewer from gauging the depth and range of the interview.
And it can also narrow the field of inquiry to such an extent you don't get things beyond. You
mm-hmm.
know, you won't get new things emerging.
So I thought it was kind of more geared towards type two
mm-hmm.
perspective. And then there's the expert interview. Goal of this type of interview would be on the interviewee's capacity as an expert, not on the fact that they're a person with perspective and subjective viewpoints.
Experts do not have subjective viewpoints.
So I thought that this one might be type one, actually. You're actually going about trying to gather information together.
You think the expert has knowledge, factual knowledge, which you're not privileged to, and so you're gathering that knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But a group of pseudo experts.
Then that would be a group, and you'd be looking more at dynamics.
Say you interview several experts and try to synthesize out, this is the knowledge that, how would you do that? Would it all be type one, where you say, I'm going to go back to Marty, you interview 10 entrepreneurs and trying to get an idea of how they define a certain concept. You have the text, of course, but then you have these people who are actually the experts at doing it. How do you then come to a final definition? Do you just compare them? I'm thinking
are they the experts at doing it, or the experts of having researched and knowing about it? It's like in my case, they're experts in terms of their experience, but they may not have had the time to reflect on their experience and build a more or less a structured knowledge base out of it.
And it would depend on the level at which you left the interview situation. If you left it purely at how would you interpret this concept, then you'd be pretty much left with type 1 information. But if you were to say, having now given me your idea about what this thing is, what's your personal experience of it? You know, now they may tell you that in telling you what the concept is, but you haven't structured the interview necessarily that way to elicit that information. Or you might say, you know, can you give me an example of when you were in that kind of situation, or and how did that feel to you, and what were how did the events unfold, and there's a lot more that would easily take you into type 2. Or even 3 again, depending on if you're interested in that. You okay about
that? I'm just wondering then, does that not then take them out of the realm of being an expert in that sense? Then it moves back into being one of the different types of an interview? But if you're, because I'm thinking from a documentary background, which is what I put this into, documentary filmmaking, where I realized this kind of a structure would have been hugely helpful for students who are trying to learn, because we would just send them out and go interview people, mm-hmm. and they would be interviewing somebody to find out about their life, or they would be interviewing somebody to find out about a concept or about different things. So that's where I related the term of expert. And to me, so if you're going to an expert, you're asking them for their expertise. Yeah. But then if you want their subjective opinion about something, then you're taking them out of the role of expert and putting them into a different. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose you could do that in the same.
I'm not sure you're taking them. They're still an expert in that field. That's why you chose them. They're just not. You're not putting them up as offering you an objective account of what it means to be an expert in that field. You're now putting them into the realm of, you know, being an expert is still a subjective experience for them.
Right.
In that field, and how they're relating to it at that level would be your focus then. Doesn't mean you wouldn't still learn a lot of stuff at the type 1 level. That's why it's quite often interesting to think about it, because you often still get everything you'd want at type 1 plus that much more. You know, purely by getting people to talk about their experience of something, as opposed to sitting there and trying to give a so-called objective viewpoint. Let's see if we can get out of the abstract and speak about something specific. So let's say, for example, we were going to ask Cheryl, in this case, what, okay, you're an expert in the area of dance, and we would like to know if you could tell us, what...
How about the difference between dance education and dance training?
Well, that's too hard for me. But that could be. But I was going to say more about this. You know, what is it, what do dancers understand by the term prima donna? Okay. And, you know, and what do you yourself understand by that term? Do you what you've told me how dancers perceive it, is that something you also buy into? You know, quite often, just that alone, people almost always will have a different view from what the collective think of something. You know, almost just because you ask them if they have one, if they agree, they'll say, well, I agree with most of it, but I see it as, you know, and then they're off into the realm of subjective experience. And, you know, was there ever a time in your life when you wanted to be like what, you know, this perception of a prima donna is, and why might that be? So. It depends on the question, but we could have left it purely at what does she think, you know, as an expert in her field, a prima donna is in ballet.
Wasn't there a practical application of, you know, from the perspective of a learning moment? And my former boss explained to me like this. He can get up in front of a class, he's a physician, and he's talking to first year medical students, and tell them the science of an ailment or of a disease. And students will take it in to the best of their ability, but they won't be able to relate to it necessarily. And then he talks about the patient that he's referring to in regard to the illness and his interaction with that patient. And students are able to at least contextualize it, and then it means all the knowledge that's been imparted to them, so they take on more meaning.
Yeah, beautiful example. Exactly, and that's partly why I hope we're we're here, we're taking this class, because we're saying, if we stay at type one, why are we not just going down the hall and learning about statistics? You know, what is it we're losing? What information are we not finding out? The humanness, the meaning making that goes on in thinking about account. And what are we not tapping into by interviewing an expert and asking them just what they think, people think about something? Good. Good analogy.
Well, what he said to me is meaning in the principle of applied physics.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Next, Lisa.
Should I keep going?
Yeah, that was great. Next piece.
Expert interview tools. We would use the interview guide as a distinct function to help the interviewers who qualified in the expert interview, which that was funny. And to keep the pride up, so you want to keep your expert in the realm of the objective and not the subjective. You want them talking about their expertise, not about their perspective. And when your interview guide is used to steer the conversation away from rhetoric, experts apparently want to talk about, I think, how much they know. That's the thing, and you want to stop them from doing that. I find the whole role of this interview guide trying to keep people on track really contradictory. Strategies and tools.
It falls within the more traditional concept, of an interview, which often people are almost structuring it to the point where they're just talking questionnaires.
There's one more type of interview, the ethnographic interview. And I guess this would be when you're in the field and you're at one with your interviewee and you're in the field, indistinguishable from your context. And your goal would be, the way I understood this, to how you want to have interviews with your interviewees in the field, but the context is so mixed up that it causes problems. Some of the problems being people don't realize that they're actually having an interview with you, and you have to use tools like, right now we're having an interview.
Or what are you going to do when you're in the gay bar and someone asks you to dance and you're saying, well, so do you come here often?
Exactly.
Tell them the context.
Yeah.
That's the limit.
I am here to ask you. So you want to be explicit and state why you're asking what you're asking, and make it be known that you're holding an interview. I thought we could take two or three, depending on your question or what you're looking at. It's not really very take one.
Okay.
Commonalities among throughout all the interviews, the protection by using the interview guide, so it's there to keep people on topic, to get data regarding your research topic. Safety, looking like an expert when you're talking to your expert. Mm-hmm. Another commonality is fear of being disloyal to your research interests. Dilemmas between pressure and time. And that's it. Thank you.
Good. So I think you came up with a more comprehensive list earlier in the class than this, even in terms of what to think about, what's going on. But at least, like I say, this gives you a place to situate your interview once you decide what kind of interview you want to do. You'll be able to perhaps have a broader place to situate it within now. And not one way. Good, thank you. Any comments or questions?